3. The small gray men could really eat. Johnny had been surprised at how well the chief had decorated the main room of the spare apartment. Colored paper lanterns with mine lamps in them had been hung about. Two paintings, one of a tiger coming toward you in the snow, the other of a bird in flight, decorated the walls. Side tables for serving had been set up. The large center table where they sat even had a cloth on it. Mr. Tsung had insisted Johnny don a gold brocade tunic, after Johnny refused to wear a robe of green satin, and Johnny looked quite nice. Some very subdued but kind of squeaky music was coming from someplace. It and the click of dishes that Chief Chong Wan kept hauling in and the jaws of the small gray men were the only sounds. Johnny had tried to invite Angus, but he had said he had to keep an eye on that moon gyro. He had wanted Stormalong to come, but the pilot was dead tired and catching naps in the ops room. He had asked Chief Chong Wan and Mr. Tsung to also eat with them, but they said no, they had to serve. So just Johnny and the two small gray men had wound up as the diners. Johnny felt that this was a pity, for there was an awful lot of food. And Johnny, so far, had no one to talk to. The small gray men just ate, and ate, and ate. The dinner had begun with appetizers, egg rolls, barbecued loin ribs, and paper-wrapped chicken. These had been served in mounds, and had all been eaten up by the small gray men. Then various noodles had been served. Pancake noodles, yat ga mein, moon yi noodles, war wonton, beef lo mein, yi fu noodles, and gorn lo wonton, tubs of them. And the small gray men had eaten them all up. Large platters of chicken had been served. Almond chicken, cashew chicken, button mushroom chicken, and lychee chicken. And the small gray men had eaten all that up. Then there had been beef dishes, Mongolian beef, sautéed eggplant with beef, tomato beef, and chili pepper steak. And they had gotten around that. Massive platters of Peking duck, cooked in three ways, had, in its turn, disappeared down their gullets. They were working now on egg dishes. Chicken egg foo young, precious flower egg, and mushroom egg foo young. Johnny wondered where Chief Chong Wan had gotten all the ingredients, until he recalled that game had been plentiful, including lots of fowl in the lake, and that the Chinese had had time to plant and harvest gardens, using an area protected by the dam armor cable to keep the wild beasts out of it. He himself had not eaten very much. Mr. Tsung had had it relayed to him disparagingly that most of these dishes were southern Chinese cookery, and that true cookery had evolved in the north during the Qing Dynasty, when his family took care of things. The Peking duck and Mongolian beef should get his main attention. Johnny had complied. It was pretty good food. Not as good, of course, as his Aunt Ellen's venison stew, but quite edible. The nurse had sent in word he was not to have any rice wine because of the sulfur, but that was fine. Johnny didn't much care for drinking anyway. These small gray men were eating the entire banquet that had been planned for 30 people. Where did they put it all? Johnny took the time to study them. Their skin was gray and kind of rough. Their eyes were a dull gray-blue, maybe like the sea, and had heavy lids. Their heads were round and hairless. Their noses took a sharp upturn just at the tip. The ears were a bit odd, reminded one more of gills than ears. They had four fingers and a thumb on each hand, though the nails were very pointed. They really looked quite like men. The main difference was their teeth. They had two rows of teeth, the second set just behind the first. Watching them eat so voraciously and hugely, Johnny tried to figure out what genetic lines such creatures might come from. They reminded him of something, and he sought to place it. Then he recalled a fish that a pilot who had been passing through Victoria had shown them. The pilot had been downed by fuel failure in the Indian Ocean and had ejected with a life raft. While waiting to be picked up, he was attacked by these fish. When he was rescued, they had shot one of the fish with a cannon and picto recorded it. It had been pretty big. What had he called it? Johnny tried to think. They had looked it up in a man book. Ah, a shark. That had been the name. Yes, these small gray men had a similar skin, similar teeth. Maybe they were evolved from sharks that had become sentient. It finally came down to tea. It wasn't that the small gray men couldn't eat anymore. It was that Chief Chong Wan had run out of food. The tea was served, and the first small gray man asked, with just a trace of worry, whether this was Yarb tea. He was reassured that it was just plain green tea, a fact that seemed to bring relief. They sat back and smiled at Johnny. They said that this was the best dinner they had had in some time, maybe ever, and Chong Wan slid out to tell and please the cook. Under their gaze, Johnny thought to himself that now they were finished with all the food in sight, they were going to try to eat him. But no, that was vaporing. They were quite pleasant, really. Now maybe he could find out what they were all about, what they really wanted. "You know," said the original small gray man, "about these hostile forces. Your trouble here was really your defenses." "Cheap trash. But that's the Cyclos for you. They never put their money in good defenses. Personnel were cheap. They'd rather buy half a dozen new females or a ton or two of Kerbango than proper armaments." He looked at Johnny as though about to apprise him of something utterly devastating. "You know how much those anti-aircraft guns you use cost? Less than 5,000 credits. Cheap trash. They won't even shoot up to 200,000 feet. Bargain basement rummage sale armaments. They probably bought them from some war surplus, used. And some executive put the new price on the books and pocketed the difference." "What should a proper anti-aircraft gun cost?" said Johnny to keep it going. The newest small gray man thought a moment. Then he brought a small gray book out of his vest pocket and opened it. The page seemed to get bigger, and he scanned down it with a little reader glass. "Ah, here's one. Surface-space combination repulsion multi-computer firing defense cannon. Maximum range 599 miles. 15,000 shots a minute. Simultaneous tracking of 130 vessels or 2,300 bombs. Destruction potential A-13. That's capital ship penetration. Cost before discounts 123,475 credits plus freight and installation. Now, batteries of those located around your strong points would have handled that entire combined force or kept them so high up they could not have launched atmosphere crafts." The original small gray man agreed. "Yes, that was the main trouble. The Cyclos were both improvident and credit-pinching at the same time. I don't think they even kept up this planet's defenses." Johnny could agree with that. He felt he was going to find out something about these fellows now that they were talking. Keep them talking. "Well, just at a guess," said Johnny, "what would you say proper defenses for this planet would cost?" He had started something. Both small gray men put their heads together. The original one started pulling all sorts of little things out of his pocket, looking into them and finding things. The newer arrival had a large ring on his left finger, and at first Johnny thought he was simply fiddling with it. Not so. He was twisting and tapping it with sudden little jerks, and a long thread, so thin as to be nearly invisible, was coiling out of the ring. They were very intense, and their voices murmured and blended together. 30 space probes, maintained carrier wave probe warning beams, 15 space drones, automatic firing, at all non-signal identified craft. Cost of equipping terrestrial craft with identification beacons, 2,000 atmosphere beacons, 256 Mark 50 combat fighters, 400 flyaway anti-personnel tanks, 7,000 anti-personnel road barricades, 100 city cable defenses with retractable gates, 50 heat color search drones, 50 automatic target destroy surface drones. They were finished. The newer one snapped off the thread at the ring and tapped it at the end, and with a little pop, the thread expanded into a long sheet of paper like a tape. He gave it a small flick, and it landed in front of the original small gray man. He picked it up, scanned the figures on it, and then looked at the end. "With spare parts and freight," he said, "it comes to 500,962,878,431 credits at 2.11% annual interest rate, plus an estimated 285,006 credits annual military and maintenance personnel salaries, housing, and equipage." He tossed the long tape across the table to Johnny and concluded, "There it is, an efficient and economical planetary defense system. All top-of-the-line merchandise. Good for 100 years. That's the sort of thing you should have had. And you can still have it." That was 498,960,878,431 credits more than Earth had. It had made him realize how broke Earth was. Now was the time to find out more about these two. "I surely appreciate your information. If you will excuse me, what are you two gentlemen, arms salesmen?" He might as well have dropped a bomb on them. They looked so startled. Then they looked at each other, and both of them laughed. "Oh, I am so sorry," said the original small gray man. "It is so terribly impolite of us. You see, we are quite well known in our respective areas. And we know so much about you, in fact, know you so well, that it just never occurred to us that we never introduced ourselves. I am His Excellency Dries Glotten, and I am very pleased to meet you, Sir Lord Johnny Tyler." Johnny shook his hand. It was a dry hand, quite rough. "And this," said His Excellency, "is Lord Voraz. Lord Voraz, Sir Lord Johnny Tyler." Johnny shook his dry, rough hand and said, "It is really just Johnny Tyler, Your Lordship. I have no titles."
"We choose to doubt that," said Lord Voraz.
His Excellency said, "Lord Voraz is the Central Director, Chief Executive Officer, and Overlord of the Galactic Bank." Johnny blinked, but bowed. Lord Voraz said, "Dries here likes to call himself the Chief Collections Executive, but it is a sort of bank joke. He is actually the branch manager of the Galactic Bank for this sector. You might have noticed a time or two that I stepped on his toes accidentally. A branch manager has total authority for his sector and is a bit jealous of his prerogatives." He laughed, teasing his junior. "Your planet comes in his sector, and dealings about it are entirely up to him. He's the one who has to show a profit for his area. Now I am simply here because the emissaries have met. These are very troubled..." Dries Glotten cut him off sharply. "His Lordship can't be expected to know all the ins and outs of sector business. He does very well to keep up with universes." Lord Voraz laughed again.
"Oh, dear. I am really sorry we worried you. Why, we have been looking..."
Dries cut him off again. "We're just here to help, Sir Lord Johnny. By the way, would you like to start an account? A personal account?" He was fishing in his pockets for the materials. "We can give you a very low number and absolute confidence assured." Suddenly, Johnny realized that he had no money. Not just no money in his pockets. He didn't have and never had had any money at all. He'd even given the gold coin away. He thought maybe he got pilot pay that was given to Chrissy, but he had never seen it. He steered off apprehensive thoughts of Chrissy quickly. He had better keep his mind on this talk. But he was broke, penniless. "I'm sorry," he said. "Perhaps later if I ever get any money to deposit." The two gave each other a quick look, but Dries said, "Well, just remember, we're not enemies of yours." "I think you would be very bad to have as enemies," said Johnny, still fishing. "That fleet wouldn't go away until you talked to Snell." "Oh, that," said Dries Glotten. "The Galactic Bank has lots of services for its customers. What you saw there was just notarial services. They needed a radio notary code trace to attest and verify that it was a valid conference order. He wouldn't take their word, of course. They trust the bank. Was calling the emissaries here a bank service, too? Said Johnny.
Well, no, began Lord Voraz.
You could call it so if you like, said Dries, for sometimes such a conference is arranged as a service. It's in the interest of the Galactic Bank to have civilized planets do business together smoothly. Johnny was not at all satisfied, but he put an easy face on it. These emissaries do seem to obey you, though. They call you Your Excellency, and they call Lord Voraz His Worship. What do you do if they don't obey you? You know, not come to the conference, or do what you say. The thought shocked Lord Voraz. Before Dries Glotten could stop him, he said, Unthinkable. Why, the bank would call in their loans, shut off their credit, their economies would shatter, they would go bankrupt. Their whole planet could be sold right out from under them. Oh, they would think several times before... Dries finally got his attention and shut him off.
Now, Your Worship, he said softly, I know you feel strongly about these matters, but we must remember that this is my sector, and things that concern this planet are my worry. Forgive me. I think possibly Sir Lord Johnny doesn't really know too much about the Galactic Bank. We haven't reprinted the information leaflets for ages. Would you like to know more about it, Sir Lord Johnny?
Johnny definitely would. He privately had become very alert about the whole planet could be sold right out from under them.